investigating a lot of sites and determining what cleanup is necessary.
I want to ask you another question, but first, just for the committee's benefit, how much money are we talking about putting into the state superfund by increasing the fee?
About $2.5 million per biennium.
Per biennium.
That is, for each $10 is worth, at today's level of disposal, in our estimates, about $2.5 million, meaning about $5 million at the $20 figure for the biennium.
But you're already, I presume you're already using the other $2.5 million, the $10 fee that's currently collected is going to something else.
Let me be clear on that. Currently, the only purposes that may be used for that fund, 85% to 100%, may be used for the matching amount on a federal Superfund cleanup site like Corvallis.
Okay.
15% may be used for investigation of potential sites. No money may be used for a non-NPL cleanup,
right,
out existing.
Right.
So we're talking about both expanding and increasing it.
So we would expand what that fund could be used for and increase the fund from $2.5 million a biennium to $5 million a biennium.
Yes.
Okay. Now, getting back to you, it seems like we're sort of, we really haven't done much. I mean, nobody can tell us what kind of cleanup is going to be required in this state.
That's
is that
right.
A fair statement?
That's probably right.
And so it's your committee's judgment that this is a far too conservative estimate of the cleanup that will be required.
I believe that's correct, yes. We don't know the answer as to how much money will be needed. The information the committee members seem to be having from their diverse sources was that they don't believe it's going to be enough.
Okay, I want to pursue this just a little bit because I think it's a real fundamental question here. Can anybody give me some examples of existing Superfund cleanups and the costs?
United Chrome, $2.5 million.
Mr. Chairman, $2.5 million for the first year costs.
Right.
EPA estimates operating the groundwater treatment system for 5 years at an annual cost of $250,000. So the total present worth over $3 million. We can give you a national figure. I want to preface that with the fact that we don't know that it's appropriate for Oregon. Nationally, EPA says an average cleanup at an NPL site is over $8 million. I don't know if that's appropriate for Oregon, though.
Okay. But I was looking at the computer printout of, 400 sites that have been identified in Oregon as potential sites?
200 plus. A little bit over 200.
200, okay. Some of them, I understand, some of them have responsible parties, some of them won't, but would you describe the United Chrome site as an unusual site that has much greater toxicity and much greater expense to clean up than other sites in the state of Oregon?
I don't know. Mr. Chairman, I would describe, based upon what we know right now, United Chrome is an average site.
That's what I was afraid you were going to say.
For what we found.
Senator Karen.
I'm finished. I mean, I don't have anything else.
Senator Karen.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Hansen, you're recommending, as I understand it, $8 for the underground storage tank. Is that annual?
That is okay. The annual remedial action piece of the underground storage tank.
Well, I understand that, but you're talking about an $8 annual underground storage tank remedial action fee, right? Mr. Cooper? Then you're suggesting that using the $8 fee is inappropriate or somehow distributes a burden to them.
The $8 fee we've been told was set only to pay administrative costs for hiring staff for DEQ to do investigations on underground storage fee tanks. Underground storage tanks that were leaking, and to make sure that if there were responsible parties, they did the cleanup and they did it right. The $8 was not represented as funding any cleanup costs for those tanks.
Okay,
we want them to stop at that level on that fee, And then go back to the other fund. There's two funds under this bill. And use the other fund for the cleanup costs if there are no responsible parties for the underground storage tanks, the same way you would be using the other fund for cleanup of hazardous waste sites.
And it's your opinion, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Cooper, that that is written or is presented, that Section 11 that doesn't provide a barrier?
As written, it does not provide a barrier.
Okay, thank you. Another question, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Cairns.
You recognize that we can't put a tax on petroleum products because of the Constitution.
We recognize that. That's why we mentioned the possibility of a constitutional amendment to do that.
Okay. All right.
I think I'm going to ask you to hold off on that other presentation about the costs, if that's all right.
Okay. We were talking at that point, Mr. Chairman, we were talking about really two things. One was just kind of how the bills fit together substantively as well as the fee. Would you want to hold off on the...
I think given the number of people who have signed up to testify and the fact that it's already 2:15 and it's Friday afternoon, I think it would be wise. We're going to have to deal with all that. And we're going to, hopefully, what I like about that is it lets us look at all these bills that we've heard in toto, which I think is very important to do. And that would be certainly my intention to bring all that stuff back before us so we get a better understanding of how it all fits in and how we pay for it all. And there will be some proposals coming forward to try to address this issue of how we fund this. So I think it makes sense.
At your pleasure. Thank you.
Further questions okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Tom Novick. And while Tom's on his way up, I wanted to acknowledge Mr. Gearhart, who is the regional administrator of EPA, is here. And I don't know whether you requested it, whether you'd like to testify this afternoon or not.
No, Sandra. I'm here to resume, but I can answer questions if they allow.
Good. Thank you for coming. We appreciate your presence.
Oh, boy.
Tom Novick, proceed.
Good afternoon. I'd like to thank the chair and the members of the committee for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Tom Novick, and I'm the executive director of the Oregon State Public Interest Research Group. As you may know, OSPRG is a statewide consumer environmental research and advocacy organization with 40,000 citizen members and 30,000 student members. We're here today to strongly urge your support of Senate Bill 122 to create a toxic waste remedial action program or state superfund. The consequences of abandoned toxic waste dumps have been brought vividly to the public's attention by events surrounding communities like Love Canal, New York, and Times Beach, Missouri. The great toxic waste mess oozed its way into the nation's consciousness and its conscience more than 7 years ago. The Surgeon General called it an environmental emergency. The Environmental Protection Agency called the situation a ticking time bomb primed to go off. Each day, more communities discover that they are living near dumps or atop ground or drinking water that is contaminated by chemicals whose strange names and initials, dioxin, vinyl chloride, pentachlorophenol, PCB, as well as familiar toxins like lead, mercury, and arsenic, have become household synonyms for mysterious and deadly poisons. The health effects from these chemicals include cancer, birth defects, behavior abnormalities, and other chronic disorders. The growing awareness of the vast toxic waste problem has bred much public anguish, but precious little remedial action. In its first 6 years, the Federal Superfund cleaned up only six sites. Although it has been reauthorized and strengthened, it still does not begin to address the scope of the problem. In response, 35 states have enacted programs to supplement the Federal Superfund and to begin cleanup in their states. We Oregonians tend to think of our state as clean, green, and free of the toxic waste problems which plague more industrialized states. While we've been spared extreme disasters, Oregon is not immune to the problems of toxic waste. As was stated earlier, over 200 chemical waste sites have been identified in Oregon. Of those, 149 are still on a list that's known as a pending list. Either they haven't been investigated or further investigation is needed. We took a few moments yesterday to point out that, in fact, these sites are throughout the state by correlating where they are to the districts of the members of this committee. And, for example, in Senator Brenneman's district, there are at least four sites. In Senator Hamby's district, at least two. In Senator Cohen's district, at least two. Senator Kintai also has two. Senator Grant Cairns wins the award with at least six, possibly more. And Senator Bradbury has at least...
Down there, an environmentally conscious and concerned Eugene.
Exactly. And Senator Bradbury, whose district is on the coast in an area where we wouldn't think of heavy industry, has at least four sites on this current pending list. Many of these require further investigation to ensure that public health and the environment are not threatened. The full scope of the problem and the precise number of sites is not now known, because no comprehensive study has ever been conducted in Oregon. Senate Bill 122 puts in place a program to identify, investigate, and begin to clean up toxic waste dumps. The potential threat to Oregon's drinking water and the environment will not go away. The longer we wait, the worse the problem becomes, and the more the inevitable cleanup will cost. Hossberg is committed to working with the Department of Environmental Quality and the legislature in designing an effective, efficient remedial action program. Senate Bill 122 begins that process, and we support its outline. Simply put, the program will identify the universe of sites in the state, classify and investigate those which are identified, and contain or clean up those sites which need remedial action. We have suggestions which we believe will strengthen the bill and make the program more effective. I would like to focus on two of those areas today and then briefly outline some other suggestions. Okay, first the issue of funding. Who will pay for the program? Hossberg believes that those parties responsible for contaminating the environment should bear the cost of cleanup. This bill, which is consistent with federal law and that of many other states, allows the DEQ and Attorney General to require responsible parties to pay for cleanups. If a party refuses to conduct a cleanup, the state can recover costs and provide for treble damages against the party. This process will work for sites where a responsible party can be found. However, orphan sites will be located, sites where the responsible party cannot be found. The company may have gone bankrupt, or the site may have been created by illegal dumping. In those cases, the cost of cleanup will be borne by the state's superfund. The proposed funding of Senate Bill 122, outlined in Section 12, is a $20 per ton disposal fee at the Arlington facility. As was mentioned earlier, the 1985 legislature authorized a $10 per ton fee to fund House Bill 2146. The $20 fee would generate approximately, I had 6 million, as we're seeing it's already going down, so I guess the reliability...
Down to 5 now, Tom.
It's down to 5. The reliability, I guess, which is a point I'll make in my testimony, is questionable. It currently costs approximately $200 per ton to dispose of waste at Arlington. The $10 fee would cause a roughly 5% increase. Since over 70% of the waste at Arlington comes from outside of the state, those who benefit from an Oregon facility appropriately should assist in funding our cleanup program. While we support the Arlington fee to get the program up and running, we are concerned that the amount generated by the fee is not adequate to address the problem. A preliminary site investigation can cost anywhere between $5,000 and $100,000, depending on the severity of the contamination. The Environmental Protection Agency estimates that an average site cleanup costs between $5 and $10 million. Even if sites in Oregon do cost less, costs add up. $5 million will only begin the job. Experiences of other states are instructive. Most have greatly increased their cleanup funds after diagnosing the problem. New York citizens recently approved a $1.2 billion cleanup fund. New Jersey voters approved a $200 million fund. Although we don't have problems as serious as these states, their experience illustrates the need for adequate funding. The federal government and many states levy what is known as a feedstock tax on petroleum-based products to finance toxic cleanup. The tax is broad-based and spreads the responsibility for funding cleanup to those who utilize the products. Many dump sites contain waste from petroleum-based chemicals, so a connection is drawn between those who use the products and the cleanup of the waste. A feedstock or petroleum refiner's tax is equitable, it provides a reliable source of funds, and it is easily collected. Current Oregon law would not allow imposition of such a tax. Article 9 of the Oregon Constitution directs funds raised by taxes on motor vehicle fuels, oil, and natural gas to be dedicated to the Highway Trust Fund. Hossberg favors a referral to the voters of a constitutional amendment which would allow creation of a petroleum refiner's tax. The tax would be levied on refiners who transfer petroleum products into the state. It is important to recognize the need for adequate funds and to move now to create them. Waiting just postpones the inevitable as cleanup costs increase with time. The second issue I'd like to highlight today is the issue of liability. Who must pay for the cleanup of sites? Osberg believes strongly that liability should be strict, joint, and several. I'll briefly outline our reasons. Certain activities are so dangerous that even when care is taken, injuries to people and damages to property are likely to result. For over 100 years, the common law has imposed special obligations on those involved in such abnormally dangerous activities. As a matter of social policy, some of these activities are allowed, but only where those responsible pay the full cost of doing business, including the cost to the community of environmental degradation and adverse health effects. One method of providing incentives for extreme caution and full compensation to those injured by abnormally dangerous activities is the imposition of strict liability. Under strict liability principles, a defendant is responsible for all damages caused to others, even if the injured plaintiff cannot prove that the defendant acted carelessly or unreasonably. In other words, negligence need not be shown. The plaintiff, which in this case could be a municipality or the state of Oregon, must show only that the defendant's abnormally dangerous activities caused the plaintiff harm. In keeping with common law trends, the sponsors of the 1980 Federal Superfund Act believe that the courts would impose strict liability, although the act did not explicitly instruct courts to do so. Since 1980, in cases that have discussed the issues, strict liability has been imposed. The Federal Superfund Amendments and Reauthorization Act, SARA, of 1986, adopted explicitly that liability is strict, joint, and several. Hazardous substance manufacturing, transportation, and disposal are known to be dangerous, even when done carefully. Strict liabilities for such activities is an accepted legal principle and should be explicitly stated in Senate Bill 122. The principle of joint and several liability permits a plaintiff to recover the entire amount of damages from any liable defendant when there are multiple actors who have contributed to an indivisible harm suffered by the plaintiff. This policy recognizes that the burden of apportioning damages is more fairly borne by the defendants. It is the defendant who has or can obtain detailed evidence about her or his behavior or that of other potential defendants. Discussion between the defendants more swiftly and fairly allocates the proper liability of each defendant than does requiring the plaintiff to identify the degree of harm contributed by each. Under common law, joint several liability is imposed where multiple parties contribute to an indivisible harm. When there is a proportional method of allocating damages, the courts do not hold the defendants jointly and severally liable. However, where a hazardous substance release contaminates groundwater or exposes a community, it is extremely difficult to isolate the harm contributed by each polluter. In numerous pollution cases, both before and after the enactment of the Federal Superfund, courts have decided that a plaintiff's recovery should not depend on the plaintiff's ability to identify the specific harm contributed by each defendant. Rather, courts have ruled that apportionment of the damages, as I said before, is a problem best left to the defendants. The plaintiff can recover the total damages from any one of the parties found liable. The paying defendant may then seek contributions from other liable parties. I should point out that the plaintiff we're speaking about in terms of this act is us, the citizens of Oregon and the state of Oregon, in trying to recoup costs that are spent on damages. The current DEQ proposal, which exempts certain parties from liability, causes us concern. We believe this proposal shifts the burden of proof onto the DEQ and ultimately the citizens of Oregon to divide liability and to determine such factors as when a particular action took place. This would be difficult and would narrow the number of parties from whom the state can recover costs, raising the state's potential to be left paying the bill. In addition, the ability to replenish the cleanup fund would be hampered by more narrowly defining liability. Finally, persons who are held liable will still be able to seek contributions from other parties by using provisions of the Federal Superfund. There are a number of other provisions which Osberg feels are important to an effective remedial action program. Provisions which specify a method of finding additional sites we feel are vitally important. In New York, a past hazardous waste questionnaire was sent to industry, and 400 additional sites were discovered. That was fully 50% more than they had known of at that point. Osberg favors this approach as an efficient, effective, and proven method. A citizen suit provision would allow Oregonians to bring suit to enforce the law. Citizen enforcement works well in 11 federal statutes and is part of the federal superfund. We feel a citizen oversight committee would also allow citizens to participate in cleanup planning. These and other provisions are outlined in the fact sheet attached to my testimony, and rather than spending a lot of time today, I hope you'll have the opportunity to read that. In summary, Oregon stands at a crossroads. Will we move forward and enact a program with adequate resources to address the problem, or will we wait for an Oregon version of the Love Canal? Osprey believes enactment of a strong state superfund is an investment well worth making in our future, and that the legislature should pass Senate Bill 122. We look forward to working with this committee on this vitally important issue. I'd be happy to answer questions, and once again would like to thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Senator Cairns.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Miller, you say, I got a number of questions. First, you talk about the industrial survey. How do you stand that up against the recommendation by Mr. Hansen for an amnesty program? Do you see that as being... how would those go together? Would you send out a notice saying if you'll report, you've got amnesty? Would you send out a report, send out the questionnaire, have them report and nail them? What would you do?
Mr. Chair, Senator Cairns, first of all, I think I should clarify. I don't believe that the department or Mr. Hansen have endorsed the idea of an amnesty
I'm
program.
I'm sorry. That's right. Mr. Cooper brought us that proposal. How would you see those as being compatible?
I'm not
Or made compatible.
Right. Mr. Chair, Senator Cairns, I'm not sure that I or our organization would be in favor of an amnesty program.
I guess that's the first question.
In large part, I feel that those parties, if they are liable and are identifiable, should in fact, as a principle, pay for the cleanup of the sites. However, we are faced with the issue of how do we find out where the sites are that are out there. Currently, we either stumble on them or find them through records or through a process, have put together a list of 200. We favor the approach that New York used, which was to send out a questionnaire with stiff penalties for not replying to the questionnaire to industries in the state saying, where have you dumped your waste in the last 30 years? Now, the compliance in New York is somewhere around 70% of those people who were questioned sent back the survey. New York is working to increase that amount by now going after the other 30%. But the increase in the amount of sites was a full 50% over those they had identified using programs similar to those that our DEQ uses. So at this point in time, I would say that we're not in favor of an amnesty program because of the principle. At the same time, we view the survey as an efficient way of getting at how many sites are out there, trying to do a sweep of the state and get a sense of how big the problem is.
Mr. Chairman, what I'm trying to get after is the question of you sent out the survey with some penalty for not responding. I make a self-report and I ring the bell with my report.
Right.
Then you come after me as a responsible party to clean up. Is that correct?
Right. Mr. Chair, Senator Cairns, that's how it worked in New York.
All right. Just wanted to make sure I understood that. The other thing, a question of private right of action. That is part of the federal superfund. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Cairns, yes, it is.
All right. Another question, Mr. Chairman, about the... have you worked with the department on this? I know this has been a priority issue for your organization in the last year or so, or however long. You complimented at some point, at the beginning of your testimony, the work of the department in bringing us the bill, et cetera. Were you involved or simply monitoring or working parallel to what's the relationship?
Mr. Chair, Senator Cairns, myself and another member of the Osprey staff worked with the Remedial Action Advisory Committee. We have been meeting with the DEQ over the last several months, letting them know our concerns. When we work on advisory committees, we certainly try and make sure those concerns come up. We still have some differences with it. So, yes, we have worked cooperatively up to this point.
One last question. Mr. Chairman, you and I, the witness and I, discussed this subject, I don't know, was a year and a half or 2 years, some time ago, I think it might have even been during the last legislative session, about the possibility of initiating this subject, and now we find ourselves with a bill instead. Is that the position of the organization? They're going to work with 122 and come to a conclusion on it in this fashion, is that right?
Mr. Chair, Senator Cairns, we are, as you mentioned, this is our organizational priority this year. We're hoping to work with the legislature to come up with a program which is strong and workable. I work for a board of directors which hasn't decided to do an initiative on any particular matter, although I must add that we certainly have seen what voters have done in other states when issues involving toxic waste and toxic chemicals have come before them. In many instances, I would say that they were far ahead of the decision makers in those states by taking measures to the ballot that were stricter, that had more adequate funding. This last election, for example, in New York, Massachusetts, California, New Jersey, measures dealing with toxic waste cleanup were all on the ballot. The lowest voter total in approving those measures, I believe, was 67%. That lesson certainly hasn't been lost in us, and we are hoping that we won't have to collect signatures, but it's an option.
Mr. Chairman, I lied. I have another question.
I'm not surprised.
You know. The matter of joint and several liability, actually, it's a comment. I want to compliment the witness on defining here the right of the person with the deep pockets to take action against those who, you know, dodged that bullet. You know, one of the problems we have in the so-called deep pockets are, you know, the Judiciary Committee is operating, you know, going through that right now. It's the same thing here. The person who gets nailed with deep pocket always has the right, as today, the ability to go into court and take action against those who didn't have the, you know, weren't nailed. And I appreciate the fact the witness has brought that to our attention. So when we get this business about somehow nailing somebody with deep pockets, we always seem to omit the fact that, yes, and then you turn around and sue the others and recover to the extent that you paid beyond your own personal, beyond your own proportion of the liability. I want to thank the witness for that.
Somebody else had a problem?
Further questions for Mr. Novick? I confess that I'm a little troubled to see us getting into a debate that's taking place now that I'm sure Senator Brenneman is quite sick and tired of in the Judiciary Committee, although it's fine. We're going to have to deal with it, and that's fine. But it just sort of makes me go, oh, no.
Mr. Chair, I realize you're referring to the whole debate over liability insurance.
Sure.
One point I'd like to make for the committee is that in those states that have modified their joint and several liability laws or have taken them off the books, even in those states they have made exemptions for toxics. For example, the state of New York, which modified its joint and several liability laws, did so but said, when it comes to toxics, forget it. It still stands the way it always has because this is an issue of vital importance. So.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it, Tom. Dave Barrows, CAM Security Systems.
Mr. Chairman, obviously I'll do what you want, but I would be happy to defer if there are some out-of-town people. And I know you're getting late on time, and I obviously will be in the building.
No, I think we're okay. Let me ask, Dave.
It's your pleasure.
Mr. Deaver, I think, is around here on a fairly regular basis.
He does come from the Portland area.
All right. Let's have Mr. Deaver come forward. And then Douglas Morrison from Northwest Pulp and Paper Association. I don't know where you come from.
Come from Seattle area.
Oh, come on then. Thank you, Mr. Barrows. Mr. Deaver, you want to come forward? Huh?
Both of you.
Well, yeah, come on. We're doing a hearing. We want to hear from you. Yeah, both of you come on up. It's fine. It saves a little time when we call people.
Yeah, you don't want to.
Mr. Morrison, why don't you go first?
For the record, my name is Douglas Morrison. I'm with the Northwest Pulp and Paper Association. We are an industrial trade association representing the majority of pulp and paper mills in Oregon and Washington. Our Oregon members include Weyerhaeuser, Georgia-Pacific, International Paper, Smurfit Newsprint, and Crown Zillerbach, and James River. I'm going to diverge from my written testimony and try and shorten this up a little bit.
All right. Great.
I think it's very important here to pay very close attention to what happened on the federal level with the federal Superfund. We have 4 years of experience by EPA trying to implement a very loosely written bill which gave us a lot of things, including a lot of litigation and very little cleanup. Starting in 1984, Congress started a process of amending that statute, and in amending that statute, there arose a number of concepts which will attempt to remedy a lot of the problems which occurred during the initial implementation. I would like to just bring up four of the major concepts that I see out of those Superfund amendments that we feel should be or is directly applicable to Oregon's Superfund program. The first of those is that expenditures from a remedial action fund should be consistent with a systematic plan for identifying, assessing, and ranking sites according to risk-based factors. As Mr. Hansen testified, that is something that the DEQ envisions doing, although I feel, and the pulp and paper industry feels, that DEQ should be required to undertake that process through statutory directive. This is important for several reasons. First, it determines the magnitude of the problem in Oregon, something which is not clear at this time. Secondly, it will give a much better idea of the funding requirements for undertaking a full-fledged cleanup program in this state. Second concept I would like to see looked at.